Thanks again for everyone being here. I know it was a really late night and it's the last day of the conference at 8 a.m., so I'm impressed that there are at least a few of you here. So I'm from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and I'm going to talk about our research focused on understanding how microbes basically change with soil organic matter using biological soil crust as our soil system. And I should also mention that I'm from Trent Northern's lab. So there are many models basically that show that oceans will have a cumulative uptake of carbon from the atmosphere. However, with land, as you can see from this, the models are all over the place. Some say that soils will be a source of carbon, while some say that soils will be a sink for carbon. So this clearly indicates that we don't fully understand carbon cycling in soils and how this is anticipated to change with climate change. But by this point in the conference, a lot of you are very familiar with all these efforts going into understanding carbon cycling. There's a lot of sequencing going on to understand the microbial community composition of soils, as well as more recently metabolomics to really understand the chemical composition of soil organic matter. However, there's this one big missing piece of information: what bridges this gap? So how do microbes impact the soil organic matter? And then the other way around, how do specific chemicals impact those microbial communities? So if we can understand what links these two very complex data sets together, you can imagine that, for example, we can start understanding how soil organic matter will change if there's a shift in the microbial community structure, which is anticipated to happen with changes in rainfall and temperature. So my goal is to determine whether or not we can use our understanding of bacterial substrate preferences, which is called exometabolomics, to bridge this gap. And then the hope is that if we can use this exometabolomics approach, we can maybe predict how soils will respond to climate change and start building better carbon cycling models. So to do this, our soil system is biological soil crust, or biocrust, which is basically a community of microorganisms that exist on the top few millimeters of desert soils, and they can pretty much exist anywhere in arid environments that can account for about 45% of Earth's terrestrial surface. So they can exist pretty much anywhere you see orange or yellow shading on this map. And there are some very important features of biocrust, which is why we chose this as a system. One is that they actually release exopolysaccharides, which allows these microbial communities to bind to sand particles and prevent erosion. And they're actually being applied to a lot of deserts to actually control dust storms. And then another very important feature is that they contribute quite a bit to soil fertility. They fix vast amounts of nitrogen and carbon. So our samples are taken from the Colorado Plateau, just north of Moab, Utah. And for this experiment, we sampled along a successional gradient ranging from early younger crust all the way up to later, more mature, darker cyanobacteria-dominated crust. These are not moss biocrust, if you're familiar with them. And then another great feature of biocrust is that they can be collected in the field in this desiccated dormant state, and then they can be brought back to the lab and stored in that state for many, many years until you're ready to do experiments. So for this experiment, we add water, and then within minutes, this wakes up the microbes. And the first one to wake up is the primary producer, Microcholius vaginatus. It's a cyanobacterium. It wakes up within minutes and starts photosynthesizing, and then this sets in motion this cascade of microbial and metabolic activity. So some other details with this experiment. We wet up our samples and collected along 5 time points, ranging from early, so 3 minutes, all the way up to very late of about 50 hours following wet up. And then at each time point along the 4 successional stages, we extracted DNA from the biocrust and have a metagenome for each sample. And then the pore water was removed, where we used liquid chromatography and mass spectrometry to understand the metabolite composition of what's being released into the pore water. We then combine these data to look at how microbes and metabolites basically change in relation to each other. So first, looking at the metabolite comp pore water, so far I've identified about 85 metabolites using LC-MS, and I don't expect you to read the names of all these compounds on the right, so these are the types of compounds we typically see. There were a lot of amino acids, nucleobases, fatty acids and carbohydrates. And what was really interesting is that all of these metabolites changed at least twofold across either wet-up or successional stage. So there was a lot of cycling going on. And then some other patterns that were pretty interesting is there's this tightly clustered group of fatty acids that were most abundant at the first time point. And then there's this large cluster, mostly consisting of all the amino acids and nucleobases that were also most abundant at the first time point to the early mid time point. And then there was a smaller cluster of metabolites that tended to accumulate over time, and that's like xanthine, cyclic AMP, so salicylic acid, a lot of random metabolites. So next, looking at the metagenome, specifically the taxonomic distribution, we found that there was a very drastic shift in community structure from early wet-up. The samples were dominated by cyanobacteria. To late wet-up, it became dominated by Firmicutes. And then some other dominant phyla included proteobacteria, actinobacteria, and acidobacteria, all of which didn't change too much across the wet-up time points. Then looking at a finer taxonomic scale, we really found that these samples were dominated by a few organisms. One, and the most abundant, was Microcoleus, which wasn't surprising. We know these samples are dominated by this primary producer. And it was most relatively abundant at the first time points and then decreased over time. And then this Bacillus became most abundant at the early to early mid time points. And then at the last time point, there was another Bacillus that popped up. So next is putting together these two very complex data sets, the pore water metabolome and the metagenome, specifically the taxonomic distribution. So before I go into those results, I just want to explain our approach of what we're using to look at substrate preferences by bacteria, which we call exometabolomics. And to do that, we take a bacterial isolate and we grow it in a rich, relevant media, such as a soil extract. And then after a certain amount of time, we profile the spent media using LC-MS again and compare it to a non-inoculated control. So the idea is that if we see a decrease in a metabolite, the assumption is that that bacteria consumed that metabolite. Whereas if we see an increase or the presence of a new peak or metabolite, the assumption is that that bacteria released it into its environment. So we used exometabolomics with 7 BioCrest isolates, Microcoleus vaginatus, the primary producer, as well as 6 heterotrophs. And what you're seeing here is metabolites all lined vertically, and then the green lines indicate metabolites that are released by that organism. Red lines indicate those that are consumed by that organism. So I'm not going to go much into the detail of this, but the biggest finding that we have is we found very little overlap in metabolite consumption, indicating niche partitioning or specialization. So that could be how they coexist in the same environment. But next, we wanted to see whether or not these micro-metabolite relationships that we observed with these isolates are also observed in more complex environmental samples, such as the intact BioCrust. So luckily, 3 of these isolates are very close relatives to the 3 dominant organisms I showed you in our wet-up study. So our hypothesis is that across wet-up or successional stage in the current study, as a microbe increases in abundance, metabolites that it consumes in isolation will be negatively correlated. They'll go down as the microbe goes up. And then metabolites that are released by this organism will increase along with the organism and be positively correlated with it. So what we found was very surprising. There was actually a lot of agreement between the isolate studies and our wet-up experiment. So as microcoleus increased at the first few time points, we found that a lot of the metabolites that microcoleus released into the environment by the isolate were positively correlated with microcoleus in our wet-up study. And then for Bacillus 1, as it increased at those mid-time points, we found that the metabolites that are consumed by that isolate were negatively correlated with Bacillus 1, and then released metabolites were all positively correlated with this microbe. And then the same thing with that late Bacillus 2, as it increased, a lot of the consumed metabolites by this isolate were negatively correlated with this organism, and released metabolites were positively correlated. So this is very exciting. Not everything agreed, I'm not going to lie to you, There were some that did not display the expected relationship based on our isolate studies, and those are shown by these dotted arrows. You can see a lot of them are ones that are released by microcoleus, and I think there's a lot of reasons to explain that. It's a very complicated organism. One thing is that it displays a day-night cycle, so it could be that these metabolites aren't produced and released until nighttime, so you get this delayed release. And that's something that we're looking more into, which brings me to my next point. We're using transcriptomics now to further link together these microbes with metabolites, so looking at the microbial activity. And luckily, we have a metatranscriptome that we collected about 4 years ago along a BioCrust wet-up, a very similar experiment. And we're starting to dive a bit deeper into those data. For today, I only analyzed microcoleus, and I can just show you a little bit of that. Basically, we found that microcoleus does increase the expression of a lot of biosynthesis genes that are involved in the production of these released metabolites. So this is showing the full change from dry to 3 minutes wet up. So immediately you get this increase in expression of these KEG pathways. And then a lot of genes that are involved in the degradation of these released metabolites either stayed the same or they decreased at early wet up. So this is very exciting, and we're going to start looking at these other organisms and see whether or not we can more firmly link together microbes and metabolites. So what I've showed you, hopefully, is that biocrusts are an amazing soil system, and they're especially critical in studying short-term and long-term succession, so we're using wet up for short-term and age as long-term succession, looking at microbial and metabolite dynamics. And what I've also shown you is that we did see a lot of metabolite cycling and a lot of microbial cycling. Also, what was most interesting is that our isolate exometabolomics approach seems to be suitable to bridge this gap between soil organic matter and microbial community composition and how they may function together. And then we hope to use more of the metagenome, so potential, like genetic potential, and metatranscriptomes looking at microbial activity to further establish this link. So I'd like to thank everyone in my lab. We all work together quite hard to come up with these relatively high throughput LC-MS approaches. Last week we had a metabolite hackathon. We sat in this office, this conference room for like 9 hours, crunching away at data. So this is everyone here working together. I'd especially like to thank Trent Northern, my advisor, and all these people for helping with sampling, computational analysis, and then Arizona State University. These people have helped us get into the BioCrust area. And then if anyone has any questions that they don't want to ask now, you can check out our website or email me. Thank you. That's a really good question. Not that I've detected. So our approach really looks at polar primary metabolites, and I'm not familiar if any of those are, how linked they are to nitrogen fixation. That is a question we're looking at, nitrogen fixation in communities, and it's complex because the primary producer in our system doesn't fix nitrogen, so we're trying to figure out who does. And we're going to start using the metagenome to hopefully identify the NIFH gene and who has it. But as far as metabolites, we haven't taken that approach. But I could try. Yeah.
Do you see any evidence of polar-sensitive molecules in the metabolites?
I haven't looked for that either. But I would imagine there is. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You talked about the metabolites that are cycling within the community. Do you have a sense from the metabolomics work what metabolites may be being used outside that crust community?
Like looking at how far they go. Yeah, we've only, so this was the top 2 millimeters, so taking actual biocrust. We didn't actually look at a depth profile or anything. That is something we want to look at to see, you know, if they're exchanging stuff with plants, even though there aren't that many in the biocrust field. I guess our assumption was that everything kind of stays within the top 2 millimeters, because that's where all the organisms are, and below that is just sand. But we're thinking that there's some kind of function in getting like phosphate or key nutrients, maybe by releasing metabolites, and I haven't looked at which ones travel further to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're doing a lot of studies looking at how far they travel. Like the microcoleus moves up to the surface within minutes. You can see it moving and turns green. It's really cool. Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. When you start thinking about a concept of mineralization in the nitrogen world, you know, I often always intrigued that, you know, organisms mineralizing to get nitrogen are really mineralizing some of these organic nitrogen to get carbon.
Right.
And you have to think about the balance there between biosynthesis and the degradation of amino acids from a carbon source perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's very interesting to bring that up, because it is extremely complicated, and if we don't see these trends that we're expecting, it's not because, you know, it doesn't support our hypothesis. There are many other reasons, and that's a good point. Yeah, I haven't really thought about it that way.
We've done some stuff with cheap grass and sagebrush, you know, in these ecosystems, and looking at mineralization, you know, phosphates of mineralization, and it always comes up with some difference between the materials and the carbon.
I think nitrogen is very important for these guys. Interesting. I believe we scan up to about 1500. Dalton, but we're just looking for the smaller stuff right now. Something I do want to investigate is looking for secondary larger metabolites as sort of like quorum sensing, antibiotic release, stuff like that. But the range we really look at is like 100 to 600 or so, a very small set of metabolites, just like the primary metabolites. Yeah. They do, yeah. So these guys are like a sponge. I mean, 50 hours is crazy. Like, I don't think there are wetting events that are quite that long. So we went the extreme. There are very infrequent wetting events, and I'm not quite sure how long they are. That's a great question. But I do know that another feature of biocrusts is that they control the hydrology, so when it rains, they just suck it up, become active, and it is important to keep those wet-up events coming, because if they're dry forever, they will die off and lose their ability to be re-wet. We've seen that with some of our lab samples that are like 7 years old, and they just won't hydrate anymore. So they need light and they need water. I'm not sure about the duration. Yeah. You can see the monomers of that. That's another area I'm investigating right now is actually like extracting the EPS and then degrading it into the monomers and then characterizing the EPS components. And I'm doing some SIP labeling to see the newly synthesized ones. But some of these could be part of EPS, and it's really hard to tell. I mean, they're wet up, and the EPS is being released. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably. Yeah. We just know that they go dormant, and how they still survive, it's amazing. But yeah, EPS is a very interesting thing to look at. But they're polysaccharides, so we don't scan up to that range, but some of these could be a component of the EPS. Yeah. Yeah.